Evening lows in the mid to upper 20s. Could see some snow by Wednesday. It's 5 o'clock.
I could not imagine all of those funding streams, all those programs being cut. That to me is just beyond the pale of political imagination.
President-elect Trump keeps saying he wants to shut down the Department of Education. Can he do that?
We'll ask this Monday, November 18th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, online orders for abortion pills have spiked.
That's amid questions about what a Trump presidency could mean for abortion access.
People are scared, and so they're trying to be prepared. So they're stocking up.
Also, should the monarch butterfly be protected under the Endangered Species Act?
But we're seeing less monarch butterflies. Now there's less than 5% of what there used to be.
And a visit to a co-housing community in Portland, Oregon, where people get to know their neighbors really, really well.
That's all ahead after this roundup of today's news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Biden is requesting more than $98 billion in emergency funding from Congress. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the money is to help address a series of natural disasters.
The money is being directed to 16 different agencies, including the Agriculture Department and Housing and Urban Development, to help repair housing and rebuild infrastructure. Since the last disaster package Congress passed 2 years ago, Shalonda Young, the Director of Office of Management and Budget, says Hurricanes Helene and Milton have torn through the Southeast, killing hundreds of people.
It is absolutely critical that these communities know that their government has not forgotten them.
The biggest amount, about $40 billion, would be for the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Disaster Relief Fund, so that it has enough money to last through the coming year. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
An attorney who represents two women who testified before a House committee investigating President-elect Donald Trump's pick for attorney general shared more details about what his clients told the committee. The attorney, Joel Leppard, said he represents two women who testified before the House Ethics Committee in its investigation of Matt Gaetz. Leppard said his clients went to more than five sex and drug parties with Gaetz in 2017 and 2018. One of his clients said she witnessed Gaetz having sex with a minor at a party. An FBI investigation into sex trafficking allegations that began in 2020 was closed without charges. If confirmed as Attorney General, Gaetz would also oversee the FBI. The newsletter website Substack became a major online forum to discuss politics ahead of the election, drawing many influencers and users away from other sites. But NPR's Winger Johnston reports profitability for the creators moving ahead is yet to be determined.
When it comes to revenue and readership, discussions around politics continue to dominate Substack. Amani Cheers, a professor of media studies at George Washington University, says she expects paid subscriptions to political newsletters on the site will rise, especially when the next administration takes over.
People want to support. They want to support. And in particular, if their favorite journalist, political commentator, they're going to look to find their unique content, their content that we're not going to see maybe on other platforms, your traditional legacy news outlets.
In 2023, Substack said it had reached 2 million paid subscriptions and more than 50 million monthly visits to the site. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
There's some speculation that some of the antitrust watchdog groups that went after big tech monopolies may be defanged a bit under a new Trump administration. Regulators began cracking down on Google and Facebook. However, many experts in antitrust rules say they expect some of that will ease. It's also expected the Trump administration could see an upside to big businesses becoming even bigger. You're listening to NPR News. A typhoon that slammed into the Philippines has left at least seven people dead. Many others were displaced. The storm caused large landslides. Typhoon Manier was one of the strongest of six major storms to strike the region in less than a month. Disaster response officials say they're looking at damage to several villages directly in the typhoon's path after it moved away from the northern Philippines. Superstar singer Beyoncé will bring her own holiday gift to football fans, providing the halftime show during Netflix's Christmas Day live stream of the NFL between the Baltimore Ravens and the Houston Texans. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggan says her appearance only raises the stakes for the streamer.
When Netflix live-streamed a boxing match between YouTube star Jake Paul and former heavyweight champ Mike Tyson on Friday, they drew 60 million households and an avalanche of complaints over bad connections and disconnected service, which raises questions over how Netflix will handle live broadcasts of two NFL games on Christmas Day, especially now that one game includes a show by one of the world's biggest music stars. Fans are also hopeful that another megastar, Taylor Swift, might show for the other Christmas Day game, which features the Pittsburgh Steelers versus the Kansas City Chiefs, with, presumably, Swift's boyfriend, Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. That could also increase viewers at a time when doubts remain about Netflix's capacity. Eric Deggans, NPR News.
Oil moved sharply higher today, rising more than 3% amid concerns about possible escalation of the Russia-Ukraine war. Oil settled at $69.16 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's 5:06. Thanks for tuning in to All Things Considered. I'm Heidi Holton. Up next, we're hearing about the future of the Education Department. We'd like to thank our business supporters, and that includes Sanford Bemidji Heart and Vascular Center, expanding cardiology services to our region. More at sanfordhealth.org. Weather around the region, we'll see some rain tonight with temperatures in the low 40s. Rain again tomorrow with highs 42 to 47. Evening lows in the mid to upper 20s tomorrow and chance of snow by Wednesday.
All Things Considered, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For years, going back to his first term in office, Donald Trump has promised this.
And one other thing I'll be doing very early in the administration is closing up the Department of Education in Washington, D.C.
I want to close the Department of Education and move education back to the states where it belongs.
And I'm going to close the Department of Education and move education back to the states. And we're going to do it fast.
Eliminating the Department of Education is in line with the conservative blueprint for Trump's second term, called Project 2025, a document from which Trump has actively distanced himself. Shutting down the department does not sit well with traditional supporters like Randy Weingarten, head of the American Federation of Teachers.
It completely takes away and abolishes this notion of opportunity for all and of knowledge for all.
Believe it or not, the Education Department in its current form is only about four decades old. It was then President Jimmy Carter, along with Congress, who elevated the department to a cabinet-level agency. Today, the department oversees everything from college student loans to aid for low-income public schools and special education. But shutting down the department, it's been a talking point for Republicans pretty much from the beginning. It was part of Ronald Reagan's plan to shrink the size of the federal government, something he talked about in his 1982 State of the Union address.
The budget plan I submit to you on February 8th will realize major savings by dismantling the Departments of Energy and Education, and by eliminating ineffective subsidies for business.
So, can President-elect Trump eliminate the Department of Education? And if he succeeds, what would that mean for America's public schools? Here with some answers, NPR's Corey Turner. Welcome.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Start right there. Can President Trump shut down the Education Department if he wants to do it?
Not on his own. No. The Ed Department, as we heard, was created by Congress, a vote of Congress, and it can only be officially abolished by a vote of Congress. Yes, we know that Republicans have won control of both House and the Senate this time around. Even so, because of the filibuster in the Senate, it will be very hard for Republicans to get any legislation passed without Democrats. Here's Max Eden of the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute.
It's really hard to see how you can do that without 60 votes in the Senate. And it's next to impossible to see how you get 60 votes on that anytime soon.
And I put the same question to Rachel Pereira at the nonpartisan Brookings Institution. She agreed Republicans are going to need help to close the department.
They would need some Democratic senators, and that seems incredibly unlikely, unless they get rid of the filibuster. I mean, that's a big question in my mind. But right now, current Senate rules, no.
It's also worth pointing out, Mary Louise, that even if the department is somehow closed, many of the things that it does, like send money, as we heard, through Title I to low-income schools, well, those would not automatically be stopped, even if the department was closed.
Oh, that's interesting. Stay there for a second. Why? Are those funds just on some kind of autopilot, or how's it work?
Well, it's because they were each also created, like the department, by an act of Congress. And so the only way to change them or stop them is, again, through an act of Congress. In fact, the Title I money that I mentioned, that program was created by Congress years before the Education Department, as it currently stands, years before it even existed. And the same was true with money that goes to support kids with disabilities. And I should also say, though, here, in all the conversations I've had, though, with folks about this idea, no one thinks that there's much interest these days in doing anything with those bedrock funding programs. Again, here's Max Eden.
I could not imagine all of those funding streams, all those programs being cut. That, to me, is just beyond the pale of political imagination.
And I think part of the reason that's so hard to imagine, Rachel Pereira told me, is that programs like Title I enjoy strong bipartisan support.
Some of the schools who rely the most on Title I are schools in poor, rural, white areas. And congressional Republicans have shown time and time again that they are not interested in hurting their constituents in that way by undoing those funding sources.
Now, I think what is much more likely going forward is to see the Trump administration really using regulations, which obviously don't require Congress, to make the department reflect its political values.
Okay, so now we get to the heart of it. What could incoming President Trump do, even if Congress is not on board with his plan to shut down the department altogether?
Yeah, so let me give you one example. So Title IX is the federal law, again, passed by Congress. It's meant to prevent sex-based discrimination in schools that receive federal funding. Well, the Biden administration used the regulatory process to interpret that law to expand protections to include sexual orientation and gender identity. But this interpretation of federal law really infuriated many conservatives, and Trump has said he will walk it back on day one. And that is something he can do. In fact, Title IX has been the subject of a kind of political ping pong match for years. The Obama administration expanded protections using its own interpretation of the law, which then the first Trump administration rolled back, wrote their own version, their own interpretation of Title IX. Then came the Biden administration's interpretation, and now I think it's absolutely reasonable to expect the Trump administration to do the same. And we're just going to keep riding this Education Department regulatory roller coaster.
Roller coaster does indeed sound like the apt term. NPR's Corey Turner, thanks for your reporting.
You're welcome.
In the past week, online orders for abortion pills have spiked. Many patients say they're worried about what a Trump presidency could mean for abortion access. Providers are worried about that, too, and about what anti-abortion groups are planning. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
In the week after the election, Angel Foster, who runs a telehealth provider sending abortion medications through the mail, saw a huge influx of orders.
It's been a very, very challenging couple of days for our team.
She co-founded the Massachusetts Medication Abortion Access Project, known as the MAP, where patients can connect virtually with a medical provider to get a prescription that's mailed to them. On a typical day in October, about 140 people filled out the group's request form. The day after the presidential election, there were more than 1,000.
So we're definitely trying to figure out what the new normal is going to look like, how we can get as much care to people as possible, and how we can do that and still stay sane.
Abortions in this country use medication, and telehealth has been a big reason the number of abortions in the U.S. has increased since the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. And that recent spike in pill requests, Foster says patients are telling her they want the medication not because they're pregnant, but because they want it on hand for future use.
They are statements like, I'm devastated by the election results. I'm scared about what's going to happen, you know, now that Trump has been reelected, those kinds of things.
The MAP is not the only provider seeing an influx of requests. Aid Access, Hey Jane, and WISP all tell NPR they've seen surges in orders for abortion pills. And some have seen increased orders for birth control and emergency contraception. Brittany Fontenot is the president of the National Abortion Federation.
People are scared, and so they're trying to be prepared. So they're stocking up. Even if they're not pregnant today, they understand, if they have the ability to become pregnant, that this care may no longer at some point be available to them.
President-elect Donald Trump has promised to veto any federal abortion ban, but he can still try to use executive powers to limit access to pills.
We're watching very closely to see who is going to be the attorney general, who is going to be the HHS secretary. So these types of appointments can have a really critical impact on abortion access.
Trump says he wants Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead Health and Human Services and Florida Representative Matt Gaetz to be his next attorney general. The AG role matters in abortion policy because that person oversees the Department of Justice and decides how to enforce laws, including the Comstock Act, a dormant anti-obscenity law from the 1800s that could be used to try and ban abortions nationwide. And then there's the Food and Drug Administration. Whoever Trump chooses to lead the FDA could restrict the rules around abortion medication, like whether pills can be sent in the mail. That's what many anti-abortion groups hope for.
We're celebrating President Trump's win.
Kelsey Pritchard is with Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, a powerful anti-abortion lobby.
The pro-life movement has a lot of work ahead of us, and we're all ready to jump in and do that.
Pritchard wouldn't say what her group wants to happen, but other anti-abortion advocates have been more clear. Students for Life of America has outlined their legislative agenda, with limiting abortion medication as a central feature. Here's Kristen Hawkins, president of that major anti-abortion group, talking about plans to pass state laws limiting access to these pills, which they call a chemical abortion.
We have bill sponsors confirmed to introduce legislation targeting chemical abortion, a very specific type of abortion, but the leading cause of abortion in our country, in 13 states.
They've enlisted the support of members of Congress, including North Carolina Republican Virginia Fox, who said this at the group's press conference following Trump's victory.
Congress, as well as all defenders of life, must continue to bang the drum on this issue and work to educate everyone we can on why chemical abortion pills and the abhorrent practice of abortion are a blight on our society.
While a Trump administration has many tools to restrict abortion access, Trump, the future president, hasn't said exactly what he'll do or when. And legal experts say it's not clear how challenges to any new regulations or laws will play out in courts. The way provider Angel Foster at The Map sees it.
We're a little bit in a holding pattern where it's the devil's in the details. Unfortunately, I just don't think we're going to know the answers to until we start to see some of what Trump puts forward.
For now, she says, her team is trying to get pills to as many patients as possible. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Sometimes we need a bright spot in our day. That's what you get when you tune in to KAXE.
And our ancestors show us, in the face of incredible adversity, what it looks like to persevere, what it looks like to keep moving your feet forward. You know, Martin Luther King talked about, if you can't walk, then you should crawl, right? But you must keep going. So my encouragement is, you do have an important role to play, and you must not grow weary in doing good. Rest if you must, but do not quit.
It's Minnesota author Sharon McMahon from a KAXE Conversation. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the bright spots that you hear. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. More is ahead from All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's here on Independent KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in. Up next, we're going to be learning more about the monarch butterfly, one of the most widely dispersed insects in North America. We receive support from Veteran Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of First Call for Help 211, providing free crisis assessment, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to veterans and veteran service member families who are in crisis. Trained veteran providers are available to serve fellow veterans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. We'd also like to thank the Minnesota Historical Society presenting holiday sleigh rides at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, featuring a horse-drawn sleigh ride through the North Woods to make holiday memories in the great outdoors. Private group reservations available upon request. More information at mnhs.info/forestholiday.
And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President-elect Donald Trump's pick to leave the Justice Department, Matt Gaetz, is continuing to generate controversy and headlines. Now, an attorney who represents two women who testified before a House committee investigating Gaetz is revealing what his clients told the panel about Gaetz allegedly attending sex and drug parties. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is here in the studio with more. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
So, Ryan, the House Ethics Committee was investigating Gaetz over allegations of sexual misconduct and illicit drug use. And I understand that you spoke with the attorney whose clients talked to that panel. What did they tell lawmakers?
Well, this attorney's name is Joel Leppard. He represents, as you said, two women who testified before the House Ethics Committee as part of the panel's investigation into Gaetz. And Leppard says his clients were among a group of four or five young women in the Orlando area who knew Gaetz and met up with him in 2017 and 2018. So Gaetz was a member of the House at that time. And Leppard says his clients were over 18 at this time period, but they went to sex and drug parties with Gaetz. There were more than five of these parties in all, he says. And one of Leppard's clients, he says, told the committee that she witnessed Gaetz having sex with a minor at a party in July of 2017. Leppard also says his clients went over with members of the committee individual Venmo and PayPal transactions and what each one was for. And they testified, Leppard says, that Gaetz paid them for sex.
I mean, I might imagine, Ryan, that this would put some additional pressure on the House panel to release its report about that investigation into Gaetz, right?
That's absolutely right. Pressure has been building on that front for a long time now. And that's despite the fact that Gaetz resigned from Congress after Trump picked him for attorney general, which effectively ended the committee's investigation. Now, Leppard is speaking out at this point, he says, to protect his clients. He says these investigations have taken a toll on them. He said his clients are not politically minded people, but they're worried about their own well-being and about potentially having to testify about this again. Leppard also said this.
There is a little bit of anxiety about someone as powerful as Mr. Gaetz coming into power and what that might look like for people that have spoken out. But it does also speak to a larger concern that there are things that people should know that they know when they make their decision.
And just to be clear here, Leppard is calling for the Ethics Committee to release its report on Gaetz so that the public and members of the Senate have all of the necessary information about these allegations when they consider Gaetz as a potential attorney general.
Right. Got it. Okay. So has Gaetz or the Trump transition team responded to the allegations?
Well, Gaetz has repeatedly denied wrongdoing. A spokesman for the Trump transition team, Alex Pfeiffer, said that these allegations are baseless. He said that they're designed to derail the second Trump administration. He also said the Biden administration investigated Gaetz for possible sex trafficking, and in that case, prosecutors decided not to bring charges. Pfeiffer also said Gaetz is the right man to lead the Justice Department, that he will end what he called the weaponization of the justice system, and he said emphatically that Gaetz will be the next attorney general.
Really seems like Trump is all in with Gaetz for now. So tell us, Ryan, where does this all go from here?
Well, our colleague Deirdre Walsh has confirmed that the Ethics Committee is expected to meet on Wednesday to consider the Gaetz report and whether to release it. House Speaker Mike Johnson said last week that he doesn't think it should be made public. He says doing so would set a bad precedent. But senators, including senior Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee, who would have, of course, first crack at Gaetz's nomination, they've made clear that they want to see what is in the House Ethics Committee's report, what they have learned in its investigation. So there may be more to come on this in the days ahead.
NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you.
Thank you.
The monarch butterfly is one of the most recognizable insects in the country. Its orange and black wings can be spotted in nearly every U.S. state. And yet, soon, federal wildlife officials will decide whether these butterflies should be listed under the Endangered Species Act. NPR's Nathan Rott reports.
The monarch butterfly presents a bit of a paradox. On one hand, yeah, you can pretty much find them anywhere in the continental U.S.
There's one right there.
Oh, yeah, there is one right over there. That's a good sign.
Like I did while talking to Karen Sinclair, a biologist at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at a park in Southern California. But...
but we're seeing less monarch butterflies.
There are fewer of them overall. Sinclair trains volunteers to count monarchs every year in Ventura, at places like this park, where the migrating insects reliably cluster come winter.
And the number of times I have had the locals walk up to us and they go, oh, what are you doing? We're like, oh, we're counting monarchs. The monarchs are here. I'm like, oh my gosh, I used to see monarchs all the time when I was a kid, you know? You could see them just dripping off the trees and I didn't think they were here anymore, you know? I haven't seen them like that in a long time.
There are two big populations of monarch butterflies in the U.S. The eastern population, which migrates between overwintering sites in Mexico to Canada, has dropped by more than 80% since the 90s. For the western population, which migrates between the California coast and the Mountain West,
now there's less than 5% of what there used to be.
The decline has spurred countless conservation efforts by states, communities, tribes, wildlife groups, and landowners all over the country. But, says Emma Pelton,
but there's been really good evidence that we are not scaling to the levels that we need for recovery.
Pelton is an endangered species biologist at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, one of the groups that's been calling for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list the monarch butterfly as threatened, not endangered.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has argued for endangered. I don't think it qualifies.
Which is an important distinction, because when a plant or animal is listed as endangered, it gets the top level of federal protection. Like, this species is nearly extinct. Do not touch or mess with it. If a species is listed as threatened, the protections can be a little more flexible to accommodate for the people interacting with the species, which Pelton says for the monarch is somewhat necessary.
We really want to see some common sense middle ground about exempting activities that are beneficial. This is a unique animal. It's in classrooms, it's in homes, it's in gardens. This is something used for education and outreach. So we don't want that be taken off the plate.
And she doesn't want a potential listing to hamper existing conservation efforts. And that's the challenge. Monarch butterfly populations are declining for three main reasons: habitat loss, the use of pesticides, and climate change. So, perhaps unsurprisingly, when Bridget Rollins, a staff attorney at the National Agricultural Law Center, talks to farmers in the heartland, people who she says are working to conserve monarchs,
there's a lot of concern about how listing the monarch butterfly could impact use of pesticides
and how it could impact where they plow or plant. Rollins says she's expecting the Fish and Wildlife Service to recommend listing the monarch when it makes its decision in early December. But she notes it would only be a proposed rule, subject to public comments, revisions, and soon, a new presidential administration.
We know that during the Trump administration, the administration was interested in rolling back a lot of environmental regulations,
including many long-held aspects of the Endangered Species Act.
So I would not be surprised to see that again.
Still, advocates and scientists like Matt Forrester, a plant and insect ecologist at the University of Nevada, Reno, are excited to see how the federal government proposes to protect an insect that lives practically everywhere, because he says it's necessary.
We all grew up with the idea that there's national parks, right? And like, they've got a fence around them and that's going to be fine. But nothing's fine now, right? All threats are completely pervasive now, and we got to deal with that.
We've got to figure out, he says, how to do conservation at a large scale. Nathan Rott, NPR News, Ventura, California.
This is NPR News.
We've been listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. We get a look at national news, and coming up next, it is local news with the Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton. Our thanks goes out to Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu is available at rapidsbrewingco.com.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Stony Point Campground on the shore of Leech Lake in the Chippewa National Forest will have a shorter camping season next summer to accommodate renovations. The popular 44-site campground is 14 miles east of Walker. The campground will be open May 9th through August 4th. It will transition to first come, first serve on July 19th in preparation for construction. The project will address deferred maintenance by constructing a new well and well house, a new water distribution system, and a new electrical system with 50-amp service to each campsite, according to the Forest Service. Leading up to the campground's closure, water may be intermittently unavailable, there may be increased noise, and some areas may be closed. Officials plan to open Stony Point Campground for its regular season in 2026. Brainerd senior Maya Taugis won the 50-yard freestyle at the girls' 2A swimming and diving state meet Saturday. The Brainerd Dispatch reports Taugis won the event with a school record 22.79-second race. She also placed third in the 100-yard freestyle, setting another school record. Taugis was also the anchor for the two Brainerd relays that placed at the meet. The Warriors took second in the 200 free relay and sixth in the 400 free relay. Brainerd junior Avery Durr was also part of the relay teams and placed 8th in the 100 breaststroke. Northern Minnesota swimmers and divers also saw success in the single-A meet. Two Harbors junior Bella Imholtz placed 6th in the 200 freestyle and 7th in the 100 backstroke. Park Rapids sophomore Avery Schuler won the 100 freestyle consolation final, finishing 9th overall. And two Northland divers finished in the top 10. ESCO senior Riley Duravec placed 8th, and Detroit Lakes senior Hope Hamm placed 9th. Northern Minnesotans have two football teams to cheer on during the championships later this week. Number 3 North Staples Motley will play in the 2A Prep Bowl at 4 p.m. Friday. Staples Motley was the 10th-ranked 2A team at the end of the regular season. The Cardinals beat top-ranked Barnesville in the quarterfinals. They beat number 2 Chatfield 36-24 in the semifinals. And they'll hope for yet another upset, facing 3rd-ranked number 2 South Jackson County Central. Number 2 North Fertile Beltrami will face number 2 South Hills Beaver Creek in the 9-player championship at 10 a.m. Saturday. The Falcons will hope to continue their dominance as the highest-ranked 9-player team remaining. Mountain Iron Buell lost to Hills Beaver Creek 20-26 in the state semifinals. Manomanwaban and Pequot Lakes were also handed losses, both falling in the state semifinals Saturday. The Thunderbirds lost to last year's 1A runner-up, Springfield, 16-30, and the Patriots suffered a narrow defeat to Dassel Cokato in the 3A semifinals, losing 26-29. This past election cycle has again raised questions about the viability of news outlets and how audiences are consuming information. New research indicates Minnesota's media landscape is on solid footing, even with some challenges. The University of Minnesota's Journalism Center issued a report on the state's local news ecosystem. Like many other towns and cities across the country, there are concerns about outlets shutting down because of dwindling ad revenue. More than 12% of all local outlets in Minnesota have closed since 2018. But Center Director Ben Toff says there is hope.
We have a lot of new news organizations that have launched over the last 6 or 7 years to, in many cases, try to fill in some of the gaps where there have been closures.
He points to the growth of nonprofit publications that have an online focus and help inform underserved populations. In Minnesota, they represent more than 1 in 5 new outlets founded since 2018. Toff acknowledges a bigger presence of outlets that bill themselves as local news providers, but are sometimes very partisan. He says they tend to push out press releases or articles generated by artificial intelligence. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Insperity, providing HR services and technology from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President-elect Donald Trump has threatened to pull the broadcast licenses of news networks that fact-check him. He has railed against, quote, censorship by social media platforms. And now he has tapped someone to lead the charge at the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, which regulates broadcasting and related industries.
We're in the midst of a very important debate right now about the future of this country, whether we're going to have free speech or whether we're going to have censorship.
His name is Brendan Carr. That was him there speaking to the Fox Business Channel. NPR's David Folkenflik is following this. And David, A, hi. And B, who is Brendan Carr?
Hi, Brendan Carr is now in his third term as a commissioner, one of five that on top of the Federal Communications Commission. He's a Republican, seen as a conventional one, used to be the general counsel for the commission, and used to be sort of intent on a fairly run-of-the-mill Republican agenda of getting away, rid of a lot of regulations, restraining, for example, corporate owners from acquiring more properties. He also more recently seems to have turned to adopt a lot of MAGA rhetoric, pro-Trump rhetoric. So, you know, he wrote the Project 2025 report section on the FCC, that is the blueprint for the Trump years that Trump has disavowed, but then again, now he's been appointed by Trump to run the FCC, and he seems pretty intent on getting in the weeds on some of these content decisions.
Like what kind of weeds? What does that mean in practice?
Well, we just heard him talk about free speech versus censorship, but it's a specific kind of framing that he's thinking about. He wants to break up what he calls the censorship cartel of big tech and the social media networks. He's particularly is looking at in some of his letters to the heads of these companies, Meta, which of course owns Facebook and Instagram, Apple, Microsoft, and not, very interestingly, ex-Twitter, which is of course owned and controlled by President-elect Trump's close advisor and ally, Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. Well, those other groups, Carr is accusing of essentially putting a thumb on the scale or worse to subdue other kinds of news that might be problematic for conservatives might be problematic for liberals or might be tending to aid the Biden-Harris administration or hurt Trump. Ex-Twitter, of course, has been accused by liberals and others of kind of throttling certain kinds of news that they want to get out there about Musk, about Trump and others. But here you see, you know, Brendan Carr is saying in the past he wants deregulation, but he's seeming to promote an agenda that would get in there. Similarly, he very much pushed the sale of TikTok. It's something that Trump at one point embraced. It's unclear now since Trump wants to pull back on the legislation that was passed by Congress to force that to happen. And so it's not clear the extent to which the FCC even oversees all these companies in this way, but he seems to be using the bully pulpit to try to make these companies take seriously the concerns he's raised.
What about the broadcast networks, which the FCC does clearly oversee, TV networks? What are they expecting if Carr is confirmed?
Well, let's remember remember, these licenses are granted for broadcasters, but they're licensed to local stations, not the network themselves. And it seems as though this is the embodiment of the Trump credo, that power comes from haranguing corporate actors and others to go in the direction you want in the absence of full executive authority, and sometimes just taking the authority you might not have. Right. What Carr has said in practice would suggest a vast expansion of that authority.
NPR's David Folkenflik. Thank you, David.
You bet.
Recent research shows loneliness is high across many demographics, but especially among parents. NPR's Katia Riddle covers mental health and has been asking, where are people not lonely? Today she reports from a community in Portland, Oregon, where some parents are defying the trends.
The meltdown started with a small thing. Rachel Damgen's 4-year-old son wanted a sucker. She said no. This was a few years ago.
And he was really young at the time, so it was like big, big meltdown.
It was the pandemic. She was alone with her 2 young children. Her husband was working. During this time, she was often home alone for 11 hours with the kids by herself.
I wound up on the floor crying too, just holding both my kids and like really feeling like, man, this is impossible. And gosh, it was just so hard. And it seems so silly because it's just about suckers.
It was a turning point. Their extended family lived far away. They needed more community, more support. Her husband, Chris Damgen, says they started asking themselves this question.
How could we change our life? How could we change our living circumstances?
The answer they found, co-housing. Now they live in a place in Portland called Daybreak Co-Housing. There are close to 200 of these planned communities across the country.
Let's see if you can kick a football and throw.
On this recent day, Rachel's 2 older kids are playing in the courtyard with a neighbor. 30 condos face out onto this shared outdoor space. A huge old maple tree sits in the middle. Okay. Families share common spaces and gather frequently. As they play, another neighbor comes by and lets the kids pet her dogs, and then more kids join in.
Hi, Riley.
Dina Kemp is 73. She's lived here for over a decade. She lost her husband a few years ago. She doesn't have any family in town.
I am not lonely. No, I miss my husband desperately.
I mean, you're a person who would be quite vulnerable to that in your demographic. You're retired. Yes. You've lost your spouse.
I wouldn't be the same person at all.
You mean if you didn't live here?
Right. I can't imagine what my life would be like.
Dina Kemp leans over and smiles at the youngest member of the Damgen family, Caroline. She's just turning 1 year old.
Dina's like probably one of the most social people I've ever met in my life.
Pretty darn social. I bake cakes for every occasion.
Rachel Damgen says it's these kinds of relationships that have changed her life as well. They aren't her best friends. They don't have every meal together, but they support each other. One day recently, one of her kids was asleep. She needed to go pick up another kid. She could not be in 2 places at once.
And I don't have that problem anymore because I could just find a neighbor to stay in my home with my kiddo who was asleep.
They've lived here 2 years now.
It's not uncommon for me to have those like hit you in the heart moments on a pretty regular basis still, where I can just, my kiddos will be like downstairs kicking a soccer ball around with a neighbor, and I've like come outside to look, and you just gotta like almost pinch yourself because you can't believe that they're surrounded by these people who are care for them.
Now, if you're a parent to young children, I know what you were thinking. Where do I sign up for this parenting utopia? But these folks will be the first to tell you that there are real trade-offs to their lifestyle. For one thing, this family of 5 lives in a 2-bedroom condo. And then there's the committees.
So there's Common House, membership.
Standing in their front yard, Rachel and Dina say there are too many to count.
Process, facilities, project management, security, facilitation, steering.
Members here agree to work on at least 2 of these committees. There's also work days, cleaning the shared spaces, doing yard work. Co-housing responsibilities take hours every week. And then navigating all these relationships.
You get to know people really well.
Chris Damgen says being in a financial relationship with all your neighbors can be complicated. There's a lot of process around decision making. It can be tedious.
And you get to know them, their quirks, their mannerisms, their emotions, but also what makes them brilliant people and what makes them maybe less than brilliant people in some cases.
Still, the couple says they've never questioned or regretted their decision, not for 1 minute. Katia Riddle, NPR News, Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Amazon and SpaceX were in court today in a bid to get the National Labor Relations Board declared unconstitutional. Their lawsuits are among more than two dozen that seek to upend the federal agency that protects workers' rights to organize and collectively bargain. NPR's Andrea Hsu joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
Andrea, if you could just start by telling us what this agency is and why it is under attack.
Yeah, well, under President Biden, the National Labor Relations Board has taken an especially assertive and some say aggressive approach to enforcing the National Labor Relations Act. That's the law that gives workers in the private sector the right to take collective action to improve their wages and working conditions, free from coercion or retaliation. Now, over the past several years, we have seen a surge in union elections. We've seen a surge in the number of charges against companies who've tried to stop or slow those efforts. And Juana, we've seen the NLRB order companies to bargain with newly formed unions to reinstate fired workers and give them back pay and more. And now Michael Lotito, who represents employers at the law firm Littler, says many companies feel the labor board has gone too far.
You know, you, the board, push me so hard, so unreasonably, at some point you are going to get pushback. And that pushback is coming in these kinds of lawsuits.
Tell us about these lawsuits. What do they charge?
Yeah, essentially, they charge that the structure of the agency is unconstitutional, that it violates the separation of powers. The companies point out the NLRB prosecutes cases, decides those cases, and sets the legal standards for those cases. Now, the NLRB's general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, calls these lawsuits a distraction. At the National Press Club last month, she made the point that the NLRB has governed labor management relations for almost 90 years. And she said, look, we are just trying to hold violators accountable. And she added this.
It would be chaos if the agency was not allowed to perform its functions and do it properly.
Now, Juana, in reality, even without these lawsuits, the NLRB is likely to be far less active once Donald Trump is in the White House. So things are going to change.
What are some of the changes that you expect President-elect Trump to bring when he's in the White House?
Well, for starters, he is expected to fire Jennifer Abruzzo, maybe even on day one, which would be a setback for workers and a relief to companies. You know, she has kept really busy actively trying to remove barriers to unionizing. And let me just give you one example of that. So one way that companies try to stop workers from unionizing is by holding so-called captive audience meetings. These are mandatory meetings during which managers or paid consultants try to convince workers that, you know, unions are a bad idea. Well, back in 2022, Abruzzo issued a memo saying, hey, these meetings are coercive and should be illegal under labor law. She urged the NLRB board members to outlaw them. And just last week, the board did just that. So now companies are really upset about this. And we can expect this and much else that the board has done under Biden to be overturned sometime in the next 4 years.
Before we let you go, who might be Trump's pick for general counsel?
Well, probably someone far friendlier to corporate interests. In Trump's first term, the job went to a lawyer named Peter Robb. He had served as President Reagan's lead counsel during the air traffic controller strike in the 80s. Of course, we know how that ended. Reagan fired some 11,000 air traffic controllers. That sent a chill through workers across the country and became a turning point for unions. Now, President Biden actually fired Robb on Inauguration Day in 2021, but someone like him could very well get the job.
That's NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Coming up next, we've got more news from National Public Radio and All Things Considered. Story coming up about Wyatt Flores. He's got a new album out. It's called Welcome to the Plains, and it's in it, there's honesty around mental health. You hear conversations like this from National Public Radio, from our local music team with Kari Headland and Malachi Coons. Lots of music interviews available at kaxe.org. Also, you can find lots of local news like this.
Walleye limits on Mille Lacs and Upper Red Lake won't change for the winter season. In news releases, the Department of Natural Resources cited healthy population trends as the reason for keeping things the same. State-licensed anglers will be able to keep two walleye 18 to 20 inches long, or one walleye of the same length and one longer than 28 inches on Mille Lacs Lake. On Upper Red, the limit is four, with only one walleye longer than 17 inches allowed. Winter fishing regulations begin December 1st and last until February 23rd.
That's the news from our newsroom. We talk fishing on Thursday mornings. You can tune in at 6:20 for our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Let's take a look at the weather. I'm Heidi Holton on this Monday afternoon. Rain overnight, temperatures in the low 40s with east winds gusting up to 40. And for tomorrow, rain 42 to 47 with breezy east winds 10 to 20 miles an hour. And it looks like Wednesday we could see some snow during the day and into the evening with probably less than an inch of accumulation. Some things going on in our region. That includes, if you'd like a Thanksgiving meal delivered to you in the Bemidji area, you can put in your request by next Monday, November 25th at noon. Also, opportunities for volunteering and monetary donations are welcome. Call us for more information.
From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's a rare thing for an artist to be this honest.
This is the only thing that I've ever cared about, and for some reason, I can't figure out. I don't feel a thing. I'm struggling with it, and I'm sorry, guys.
23-year-old country singer Wyatt Flores faced a crowd full of fans in February. He was in the middle of a major tour. His music had just blown up, and he was overwhelmed.
I'm just writing the entire time. And then all of a sudden we hit the road and start touring again. And I was like, what? I can't do this anymore. I'm either going to end up dead or never coming back to music.
Flores's early music was often about death, sadness. He says he's always been open and honest about what he's feeling. But this moment of vulnerability on stage was just as important.
We posted a video from it just because I was like, well, we're going to be open about it. You know, talk about mental health in every single show, so why wouldn't I show him this part?
Flores took a break from the road, went to therapy, and less than a year later, he's already back touring. And he has a brand new album called Welcome to the Plains. Compared to his last project, the album is joyous and happier. It's a celebration of life and of the people and places that made Flores the person he is today, like his home state of Oklahoma.
Now it's red dirt tears and broken mirrors in a little trailer park just south of here. End of the world is getting near, but I still feel the same.
The biggest compliment that we get is we're the nicest people. And I'm very proud to say that because we are. You can walk in anywhere. Everyone usually holds the door open, says yes, please. The manners are just amazing over there. But the people are tough. Just the farmers that I've worked for. And I mean, this year, soybeans are, they're dried up. They're not even going to have a harvest. It's a constant struggle in Oklahoma to try and make it out. And I know from personal experience of trying to get out of Oklahoma, I fought really, really hard to make it out of my town and go and make a name for myself. And now I'm fighting with everything I have to make it back.
I know that you are someone who grew up around music. Your father was a musician in a band in the 80s and 90s. It feels like that's always been a constant to you. Is there any one memory you can share from growing up about the impact that growing up in that kind of culture had on you?
Oh, man. There's so many memories because my dad's been drumming in bars since he was like 12. I wanted to learn how to play drums, and I didn't even want to be a singer-songwriter. I just wanted to learn how to play lead guitar, which I'm still working on. But yeah, without my dad and him teaching me in our shop, in our garage, of sitting there and learning how a band really operates, I don't believe that I'd be sitting in this chair because, you know, so much of today's music is, they call them TikTok artists. Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah, in a way, I'm using everything that I possibly can to get recognized. And TikTok is just another tool of platform. But what's different from a TikTok artist and a real artist is when they go and play live, and if they can. And I'm very lucky that I had the background that I do, and my dad being able to sit there and me and him just jam out.
Is there a song on your new album where we hear echoes of that early influence, that familial love of music that your dad helped build up in you?
I don't know. I wanted to create an album that in some ways made people proud of America again. Now I'm holding on. Every I really wanted to find something that was like, made your heart feel a little bit happier about where you come from instead of all the chaos of things going on. I mean, just watch the news anytime. There's so much ruckus going on. I just wanted to give people a little piece of hope, I guess. Let's get it.
I want to talk about a different song, and it's a song that you've said is one that you really wrote for your fans. It's the song, Oh Susanna. Let's take a listen.
Oh Susanna, don't you go crying for me. It's all getting better. I couldn't be who you want me to be. Thought I was a savior. But I was a fool on drunken behavior. Why did I believe I could save you, darling, without killing me?
Wyatt, what were you hoping to tell your fans with that song? I mean, it's so deeply emotional and clearly so personal.
I was trying to help as many people as I possibly could because a lot of people were like, your music is saving me and keeping me going. And then I'd have conversations with fans, which I've had to come down on my VIP experience just because there was a lot of trauma dumping. And I didn't know how to handle that.
Yeah.
I mean, one of our first sold out shows was in Asheville, North Carolina. And I met with 300 people. I just told them, line them up, and I'll talk to every single one of them, sign everything. And within the first five people, I had a kid come up to me and hand me his buddy's ID. And he goes, I promised him that I'd get something signed because he had committed suicide. And with Oh Susanna, it was an apology of just being like, I can't actually save anyone. I'm glad that this music has done the things that I want it to, because I want to be there for those that need it. I mean, I want to help, and I want to change the world, but I can't physically do that. And it's a hard thing to do, calling yourself out. You know, I was a fool on a drunken behavior, and that's just the absolute truth. I was, because I didn't know how to deal with it all, and I didn't know how to help really anyone because I wasn't helping myself.
Only trying to be the cure, I was the problem. Only trying to be the cure.
And honestly, I learned that in my personal life too, of having to take steps back from people and try again, because sometimes you just get caught up in it all. Of trying to help, and that's where, like, the codependency thing, I'm still trying to figure that one out. At least noticing it now and being able to look at it and try and give yourself a healthy step back so that way you can take care of yourself before you take care of others.
So you've got this new album that's out, and you're also back on tour. How does it feel being out there in front of fans performing live?
It's still the best feeling in the entire world. Watching the crowd sing the songs back, I mean, that's always the scary part. It's like, well, I'm going to rip my heart out and put it on display for y'all. Hope you like it. And then to see them sing these songs back, it's the coolest feeling, and it never gets old. I did not expect this album, and I just can't believe all the blood, sweat, and tears, the sacrifices that went into it, and then to see the reactions of fans, that's the coolest part.
We've been talking with Wyatt Flores. His latest album, Welcome to the Plains, is out now. Wyatt, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm missing someone damn near all the time. Right now they're weighing heavy on my mind.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, committed to moving the world forward and working to tackle some of society's biggest challenges. 9 campuses, 1 purpose, creating tomorrow today. More at iu.edu. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
Coming up, we'll have the news from Canada. It's As It Happens. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and the land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. We operate translator K210DR in Brainerd, 89.9, and you can listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you so much for your support. Let's take a look at the weather around our region tonight. We are looking at temperatures in the low 40s. East winds could gust up to 40 miles an hour. Tomorrow, rain, 42 to 47. Breezy again, and evening lows.